Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning. This hour of the program, the debt ceiling. Our guest wrote in a recent piece in Bloomberg Business Week, suppose Congress fails to raise the national debt ceiling before the federal government reaches the current limit of $14.294 trillion, which is expected sometime around May 16. How bad would it be? Despite the full faith and credit of the United States of America is no small matter, which makes it all the more frightening that so many Americans want to see it happen. 46% of those surveyed in a March 31st through April 4 Wall Street Journal NBC News poll said they opposed raising the debt ceiling. The pollsters asked the question again after giving the two sides of the argument. Some say if the ceiling isn't raised, bills, benefits, government salaries, and interest won't get paid. Others say raising the ceiling will make it harder to get the government's financial house in order. We'll talk about this debate, really, about the debt ceiling. We'll learn a little bit about the history of it, why we have it, what it means, whether or not there are to be concessions made on the part of those people who want to raise it in terms of cutting spending for programs to get votes from some who oppose raising the debt ceiling. Our guest is Peter Coy. He is the economics editor for Bloomberg Business Week and covers a wide range of economic issues. He's also the senior writer. Joined the magazine in 89 and became technology editor in 92 and then became person who writes on the economy. He came to Business Week from the Associated Press in New York, where he had served as a business news writer, and before that worked as a correspondent in the AP Rochester Bureau. He began his career at the AP in 1980. We're going to be welcoming phone calls. I would imagine we'll have many. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Peter. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So give me a little history and a little description of this debt ceiling. Why do we have it? How long have we had it? And what exactly is it?
The debt ceiling goes back to the early part of the 20th century. And the thought would be that, well, this will just be a law that says Congress can't get itself too far into debt. But, of course, any law that Congress passes, it can also amend or change or override, and that's what it routinely does. It just, every time we come up against the debt ceiling, Congress raises the debt ceiling. And so we have this great chart appearing in the magazine showing the two lines. One is the stair-step pattern of the debt ceiling itself. We took it back to 1995. And then right under it is this line of the amount of debt subject to the debt ceiling. And you can see exactly that pattern, that we come along, they raise the debt ceiling, and there's a little bit of breathing room, but then we catch up to it, and then raise it again, and, you know, lately, the increase in the national debt has been accelerating. It's just gone crazy since around the year 2000, and so we're coming up faster and faster against each increase in the debt ceiling, and it looks like we're going to need, as you said in your intro, another increase as soon as next month.
And how often have we come up against the debt ceiling?
Well, lately it's been happening, you know, as often as a few times a year, because they're just raising it a little bit at a time. It's a way, politically speaking, it's a way for Congress to show that it's serious about not letting the debt get out of control. And if they raise it too much, it's almost like admitting that that our spending is completely out of control. It also gives some political power to the people who withhold their votes. Now, the pattern is that the party that's not in power tends to vote against raising the debt ceiling, forcing the party in power to, in Congress, that is, not in the White House, but in Congress, for the party that is in control of Congress to muster all the votes, and then it becomes, you know, a handy political weapon. You know, you voted in favor of raising the debt ceiling.
Right.
Even President Obama, when he was a senator, played that trick, voting against an increase in the debt ceiling when President George W. Bush was president. So there's a time-honored tradition of political gamesmanship here, and we're seeing it playing out again now.
But is this more serious political gamesmanship now than it has been in the past? We seem to be talking about it more than we ever have.
I think it is. I think it's a good idea to have this program because this really does need some airing. I think there's a difference now, and it has to do, I would say, with the Tea Party. Tea Party advocates are very strongly against, well, two things. They're against debt. They're also against big government. And they're, I would say, more ideological about it than your average politician in Washington. In other words, they're not just treating this as business as usual. They're absolutely furious about what they see happening in Washington. And the politicians who want their votes are feeling emboldened to play tougher on the debt ceiling than they might have in the past. So you actually see statements from members of Congress, members of the House and Senate, saying, no, we are really, really not going to vote to pass an increase in the debt ceiling, come what may. Some of them will say, we will only vote yes if we get the concessions we want on spending cuts. Others will just say no. Senator Rubio from Florida, amazingly, wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal, which I quoted in my article, the end of March, where he came right out and said he doesn't really buy this argument that the raising the debt ceiling is necessary, and he just votes against it.
Mm-hmm. Is it unclear at this point in time what kinds of policy disputes have to be laid to rest in order for there to be an agreement to raise the debt limit, that we need to know exactly, this is what I want, and then I'll vote for you? Do we know what those disputes are?
Well, we know generally what they are. I mean, it comes back to all the issues we're so familiar with by now. If listening to programs like yours, you know, what should be done about Medicare? What should be done about Medicaid? What should be done about defense spending? Discretionary spending, non-defense discretionary spending. I mean, every category has a whole range of arguments about it. Your congressman there, Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, obviously has the leading Republican plan at this stage. Obama's out there with probably the leading Democratic plan. And then you have what I wrote about in this article, the Gang of Six. These are six members of the Senate, three Republicans and three Democrats, who are trying to pull together as much support as they can for a centrist solution, which would probably involve a combination of cuts in spending and tax increases.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think that they're onto something there, because it's pretty unlikely that the and Republicans are going to vote for anything too close to the Obama plan, and vice versa for Democrats not going for the Ryan plan. So no matter how you feel about the particular provisions of either plan, you've got to think that the ultimate the business as usual in Washington, which is that the deficit and the debt therefore increase because the Democrats won't go along with spending cuts and the Republicans won't go along with tax increases, and so they compromise by just overspending, deficit spending. That can't go on. So it's got to be some kind of meeting of minds in the middle, and again, the Gang of Six seems to have a sort of a regional centrist approach going on.
And it would the you write in your article that what they're thoughts are have been kept pretty secret here,
yeah.
but they may indeed be in line with the bipartisan Simpson-Bowles Commission that the president cited in his April 13 speech, along the same lines? And if so, what are those lines?
Well, yes. You know, you're right that we don't know what the centrist approach might be. The only thing we can do is guess that four of the six members were on that bipartisan commission, the Simpson-Bowles Commission, that came out with its report back in December, and the other two who are the leaders of it obviously recruited them, so they must have some sympathy with that viewpoint. But so what is it? Briefly, it on the tax side, it would close a lot of the loopholes in the tax code. you might not call them loopholes, but effectively they reduce the amount of tax that it comes into the government, tax revenue from any given percentage rate. Things like the home mortgage interest deduction, which is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Things like the exclusion for state and local taxes paid. Things like deductions for charitable contributions and for education and so on and savings. These are not all bad programs. In fact, they've been put there for a reason, that some of them actually do good things. But there's a general principle in economics, which is that when you raise a tax rate, then you discourage whatever it is you're taxing. So a high tax rate on labor discourages people from working. High tax rate on savings discourages us from savings. What you're best off with is a low tax rate. And how do you get a low tax rate? By broadening the base of what you tax, by excluding as little as possible from the tax base. So broadening the tax base by reducing the number of deductions and exclusions and credits while actually lowering the tax rate could produce stronger economy and more revenue. And we can talk about the spending side as well, but I just started with a tax.
Yeah, that's fine. Let's start with the tax. What about, I hear differing figures on this, if you were to increase the tax rate of the top 10% or top 1% of income earners in the United States, how would that affect the deficit? Would it really take a big chunk out of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the people who are against doing that say it wouldn't solve the problem, and it wouldn't. The debate there is partly an economic one, partly, you know, an ethical one, philosophical one. The rich people in this country pay a vast majority of the total income taxes that are paid. I saw a calculation recently on the White House website, actually. It took a family of 80,000 with an annual income of $80,000, which is, you know, not bad. It's above the national median for sure. And yet, even that family paid relatively small tax bill. They paid under $4,000 in annual income taxes. They paid over $6,000, meanwhile, in Medicare and Social Security taxes.
Really?
So you have to go up relatively high in the income structure before income taxes start to become a big deal. So you have... Then the issue is, okay, that's where the taxes come from. They come from the rich, and so you could argue they're paying more than their fair share. They're also making a lot more than everybody else. So as a recent cover story in Business Week that I was not involved in pointed out, my colleague here at Bloomberg News, Jesse Drucker, there are rich people in this country who pay almost nothing in taxes. They can reduce their income taxes to effectively zero through a clever shielding, which is available only to millionaires or billionaires with fancy tax lawyers and accountants.
Right. Is there a figure that is one that we ought to look at as to what the debt ceiling should be? I mean, can you come up with a number if you were to recommend, here's what the debt ceiling would be, what would it be?
Well, obviously, it's just a matter of how long you want it to last. If you want it to last for a year, you'd raise it by a few hundred billion. If you want it to last a few more years, you have to, because we know we're on a trajectory to have the debt keep going up and up. Even under the Ryan plan, we're running deficits for a long time to come. What we want to be doing is not worrying so much about exactly where we set the debt ceiling, but coming up with a plan that will start to put U.S. finances on the right track over the long term. And to do that, we're going to have to deal with the biggest causes of the big deficit, and those are the entitlements.
Right.
As well as the shortfall in tax revenue. So entitlements being the most notable ones are Medicare and Medicaid.
Peter, who owns the debt?
The debt is owned by a combination of Americans and foreigners, and actually I can't tell you right now the breakdown, but treasuries, I believe something like half of them are owned outside the United States. The Chinese and the Japanese have incredibly huge holdings. The There's also big chunks in places you wouldn't expect, like Singapore, Korea, Saudi Arabia, Britain. All over the world, our treasury bonds are held. We do have one big advantage that a lot of countries don't have. Our debt is denominated in dollars. So we this is both a good and a bad thing. If inflation rose in the U.S., then effectively it would be a way to repay the debt with cheaper dollars, and it would hurt the foreign investors, but it would make it more tolerable for the U.S. government.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Peter Coy is our guest. He's economics editor for Business Week, and he covers a wide range of economic issues. We're talking about the debt ceiling this hour of the program, but of course that encompasses spending and taxes and entitlement programs and the whole ball of wax. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. We have one line open if you'd like to take it. Right now, it is yours. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program this Thursday, we will have our April open line. So put your thinking caps on and come up with brilliant program suggestions. I know you will the second hour of our program today. We go to phone calls. Marshall and Stoughton, our first caller for you. Peter. Hi, Marshall.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm wondering for your guest if he understands why Americans are so infantile as to say that you can't touch Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security, when anyone should know that if you can't touch those, you cannot solve the deficit problem.
Peter.
I agree that with the caller that those have to be part of the solution. And I just think, I wouldn't use the word infantile, I would just use the word people looking out for their own best interests. It's interesting that even Paul Ryan's plan would not affect benefits for people who are 55 and older. Well, you know, my father's 86, so I can afford to say this. People who are on Social Security, Medicare now have gotten a great deal because the benefits that they're receiving are greater than what they paid in, even adjusting for, you know, the reinvestment of their funds over the years. And that's going to change for the younger generation. The benefits that they receive are going to be smaller than what they paid in. So you could argue that even today's recipients should be part of the solution. Now, the trick, of course, there is that they have less, they can't adjust the same way that younger people can. If you take away some portion of their benefits or the curtail the increase in their benefits, then they have fewer opportunities to sort of compensate. But young people are in a jam, too. It's not like they're in a situation where they can just suddenly, like, earn a lot more money to make up, to increase their savings so that they'll be able to bear more of this burden themselves. So I do agree something needs to be done about Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid, and I think it needs to be a broad-based solution, but it needs to begin now, and it needs to be phased in, and it probably needs to involve some kind of means testing, which is a controversial point, but it seems to me that the people at the top end of the income scale are less in need of their Social Security checks and Medicare payments than the people farther down the scale.
Mm-hmm. You also said something in your article of April 13, which I'd like for you to elaborate on. Fixing health care entitlements will require a combination of less generosity and greater efficiency. It's crazy, you write, that Medicare devotes about 28% of its budget to recipients' final year of life and is moving to pay for costly cancer drugs like this $93,000 a year Prevenge. There's a whole philosophical discussion that we, for whatever reason, because maybe it's because we don't want to think about the fact we're all going to die, that we don't want to have.
Yeah. It's so funny. You started out talking about the debt ceiling, but before too many sentences, you find yourself grappling with life and death issues.
Exactly. Right.
It's fascinating, really, and that's why this is such a good topic for a program. But, what do you do about this? There are medicines which, if prescribed to people with, you know, certain cancers, for example, will extend their lives. Does that mean that, therefore, everyone who could benefit from that treatment should receive that drug at government expense? Well, there's an argument that yes, I suppose. But you have to think what the trade-offs are.
Right.
What else could be done with that money? The money's, not infinite. Should the money instead be given to women with infants and small children so that they can grow up healthier and stronger and more productive and happier? Just as an example out of a million.
Right. And who's to make those decisions?
Right. So you bring up who's to make those decisions. I can jump right into one of the big points of difference between Obama and Paul Ryan, and that's the what to do about the aspect of the Affordable Care Act, the health care reform law, which would create a panel within Medicare which would decide what treatments to allow and which ones to disallow. And Obama's in favor of it. Ryan's against it. I would argue that because he says, why are we allowing those decisions to be made by an unelected board that should be in the hands of Congress? Well, I would submit that Congress hasn't shown much discipline about that kind of thing until now. And I don't see them gaining a whole lot of backbone in the future. But what the Republicans and Ryan are effectively saying is that we are just going to reduce the amount of money that goes to Medicare and kind of rely on the market to decide what can be afforded and what can't. People, what that means is that the people who can afford that Provenge, for example, the $93,000 a year drug, will get it. And those who don't have that kind of money won't get it.
Thanks, Marshall, for your call. Scott in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, that's a whole nother two or three shows, but that would be a great show. I mean, you almost want a two-tiered system where everybody participates and everybody gets standard benefits, and then if you need something on the outside, you get a private plan also. I think that might save money. But to my original point, I don't think the president and the Democrats really want to have a serious conversation, because what you hear, and the media does a great job, is we need to tax the rich, go back to the Bush-era tax rates. You know, we can't have tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. Here's the truth. If we went back to them, which is fine, I don't have a problem with that, that will generate $80 billion a year. It's $800 billion over 10 years. $80 billion a year when we're running a $1.46 trillion deficit right now is an accounting error, is what it is. And everybody on the left is demagoguing this issue. You had the president's own debt commission, who he punted on. How many times do you hear about Ryan wanting to lower tax rates for millionaires and billionaires? Guess what? The president's own commission recommended basically the same thing when it came to tax rates. You know, opening up the tax base more, but lowering the rates. You don't hear that in the press ever. And all you have is the Democrats and the president demagoguing this issue. We're never going to get there when we're dealing with it this way.
Peter.
Yeah. One thing I would like to point out is that wasn't the president's commission. It was a bipartisan commission, which was intentionally stacked with both Republicans and Democrats. It was not the solution that the Democrats would have come up with if they were on their own. The Democrats would have probably come up with wouldn't have wanted to cut the marginal tax rate the way that plan proposed. That's why I said it's a centrist plan that has the potential of earning support from both Republicans and Democrats.
Thank you very much, Scott, for the call. Phyllis is next in Waupaca. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. First, I wanted to say that the American people paid into the Social Security and Medicare plan. It's not a gift from the government. And I also wanted to ask a question and sort of make a comment. Is it correct that Social Security and Medicare payments go up to a certain level, and then, like for the super wealthy, it's cut off at a certain point? And if that is the case, it seems like they should have to pay that percentage regardless of how much money they make. And also, I wanted to comment that I think that we should monitor how people vote regarding this debt thing. If they voted for it in the past, but they won't vote for it now that there's a Democrat in office, that should be made known.
Okay, Phyllis. Peter.
A lot of points in there. I want to start with the first one, which is that Social Security and Medicare are not a gift from the government. That is true. But the point I was trying to make is that if today's 70, 80-year-olds had put the money that they paid into Social Security and Medicare into private insurance, they would not be getting the benefits they're getting now. They'd be getting smaller benefits. And that's because it's not a traditional investment pool. It's essentially a pay-as-you-go system where the money that is paid in by today's taxpayers is paid out to today's recipients, and it's always been that way. There is a trust fund, but it's sort of an accounting fiction in that all the trust fund does is hold bonds issued by the government. So it's like from one pocket to another. Point being, to keep it simple, so today's recipients are getting a good deal, and it's a better deal than tomorrow's recipients are likely to get.
Here's an email from Bernie in Elkhorn. Once again, a guest has framed the debate as a choice between entitlements that we've paid for through our paychecks and raising taxes on the average American. What about changing policies? The real military budget, this is something we talked about yesterday, is $1.2 trillion a year. Also, trillions have been and are being poured into corporate subsidies, tax loopholes. What about the $50 billion a year drug war? What about putting in place a meaningful estate tax? It is not a choice between entitlements and taxes on most of us.
Yeah. You know, this, again, comes back to the idea that the budget, in a way, is a statement of what this nation is all about, what it wants, what its people want. And so you very quickly get into every single hot-button issue in the world, from drugs to Afghanistan to Iraq to corporate subsidies. And I don't think we want to run too far afield in this this hour, but I agree with the caller that anything you do, it's all a matter of choices. And everything really should be on the table. You can't just, like, wall off defense, for example, and say, well, because we believe in a strong defense and military, that we'll just not even open that part of the budget. Everything's got to be looked at, because this hole we're in is too big to limit the scope of the analysis.
Mm-hmm. What kind of, I was reading an interesting article this morning about the first-term Republicans in the House who have found themselves, their doors being knocked down by Wall Street banks, big business, and the Treasury, pressure on them to vote to raise the cap on U.S. borrowing. Can you tell me about the lobbying efforts and why Wall Street would be involved in lobbying these freshmen, and whether or not it doesn't make much difference who knocks on their door, they're, because of their political philosophy, just not going to vote yes to this?
There are a lot of things that the a lot of things that Treasury debt does that are invisible to the American public. First of all, it's a AAA-rated security. It's the safest thing that exists. And so it becomes a benchmark for all kinds of the derivatives that Wall Street trades. This is something, an aspect of the problem that President Obama is never going to mention, because it's not the kind of thing that generates an upwelling of sympathy.
Right,
in the general
I would
public.
Imagine, right.
But I think that's what Wall Street is concerned about. They want to make sure that the U.S. retains its AAA credit rating. Partly they own a lot of those bonds, and they wouldn't want to see them lose value. Mm. And secondly, again, that they're used as sort of part of the raw material for elaborate trades and derivatives and so on. That's not what I don't think most of us need to be concerned about. We, the general public, should be concerned about raising the debt ceiling, because if we don't, then one of a few things is going to happen. Medicare payments are going to have to be curtailed, which is kind of unimaginable. Medicaid payments to government workers, state and local aid, soldiers. You know, I'm saying it's hard to imagine any of these things happening, but that legally they would have to happen if we hit the debt ceiling that wasn't raised. Or the government would just start defaulting on its debt, which is also kind of unimaginable. There's only so many tricks. The Treasury Secretary figures he has maybe 2 months' worth of accounting gimmicks he can draw out of his bag of tricks to keep from defaulting. That might take until sometime in July. But if the government still hasn't come up with a vote in favor of raising the debt ceiling, then some of those bad things would happen. If we defaulted on even a portion of our debt, there are certain pension funds and other holders which would be legally prohibited under their own covenants from holding that debt. The interest rate on the U.S. debt would go up and wouldn't come down again quickly, and therefore we'd be in an even deeper hole because our interest expenses would rise.
Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a catch-22. If you don't do this, the rates are going to go even higher.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mark in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
Stay with me on this one. It's trying to get all this out. Back in the 50s, the upper-income people were taxed around maybe 90%, somewhere in that area. Now it's down to 35. Some are pushing it down to 25. They want to see it go down to 25. But some are saying, well, that's really only going to be an insignificant amount of extra revenue if we raise the taxes to the rich back up. We've had 10 years of two wars. We've got a lot of cost to be in the war, plus a lot of cost keeping injured soldiers alive. We've got retirees that are now cashing in on Social Security, older folks that are cashing in on Medicare and Medicaid. I'm saying, look, is there anybody out there in the world that can put some real numbers to this instead of this demagoguery sort of fight? What's going on with the numbers? Where's this $14 trillion really coming from? Is it just because we've got a huge amount of interest to pay? And then the final question is, if that's true, and we saw trillions of dollars disappear overnight with the crash a couple years ago, why can't we make the numbers reappear, the money reappear, just by printing more?
All right. Peter.
Yeah, that's kind of a wide-ranging question. The debt, if you look at where the huge increase in the debt came from, put it this way, as recently as 2005, it was around $8 trillion, beginning in 2005. Now it's over 14. So we had a really bad 6 years here, five, 6 years. And it's really from a combination of the Bush tax cuts and the recession and really in the wars, of course, but those three things are what did it. The recession, don't forget, we're still recovering from it. A lot of people still out of work. And we are, so it's not only hurting individual Americans who can't get jobs, it's hurting the federal government because income tax receipts are running below normal, and payments are running above normal. All the sort of automatic stabilizers built into the budget, welfare payments and unemployment compensation and so on, are running above normal. So we have an unprecedented gap between the revenues of the government and the expenses. Now, that's going to shrink as the economy recovers, but the debt that was incurred during this period is not going to go away.
And what assurances do you have that our economy is going to recover as rapidly as we need to? Is it recovering substantially?
It is recovering gradually.
Mm-hmm.
The recession actually ended in, I think, May or June of 2009. It's been almost 2 years now of quote-unquote recovery, and we still have an unemployment rate of almost 9%.
Mm-hmm.
We have enough material here for like a month's
worth
of show.
I know. We can just keep talking, Peter.
I know. It's just the way this intersects with the debt debate is that if you aggressively cut spending right now to close the debt gap, then you actually would jeopardize the economic recovery and possibly make the debt worse in the long run for exactly this reason. You need to have a vigorous economy to generate the tax revenue and to hold down the social spending. And without that, you'll get into a situation such as Japan has, where they have some of the world's highest debt-to-GDP ratio, despite a very high household savings rate. It's all because their economy just has not gotten going again in a sustained way since 1990, more than 20 years. We do not want to get into a Japanese-style slump.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Peter Coy is our guest, economics editor for Bloomberg Business Week, and we're talking about the national debt ceiling and whether or not it needs to be raised, because we're going to come up right against it probably, our guest says, around May 16th. Here's our phone number. Thanks, Mark, for your call. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have our April open line, the second hour of our program today. It's your monthly chance to call in with program suggestions for the 9 to 11 o'clock hours. So we listen to what you say. So call us. John in Milwaukee is next. Hi, John.
Hi. I was thinking one of the ways you can reduce the debt, and I think it would happen real quickly, would be if you look at the Defense Department more like homeowners insurance. When you buy a big house, you pay more for your homeowners insurance than if you have a small house. Now, if you couple that fact with the statement that Michael Moore made, that there are 400 families that own more wealth than 150 million Americans, or half of America, what we have is we have a Defense Department where we are defending the wealth of these 400 families, and then we're billing 150 million Americans who really don't have that wealth. The Defense Department is an insurance policy to protect the wealth of those 400 million, or those 400 families that own more wealth than 150 million Americans. I think that if we changed the Defense Department funding so that it was more related like homeowners insurance, that the people who have the bigger houses are paying more to defend that property, and we could do that in two different ways. You could do that either with an asset tax that taxed these 400 families that own more wealth than 150 million Americans through an asset tax, or if you went towards capital gains and you increase the capital gains tax. If you look, most of the extreme wealthy people are not paying their taxes through income taxes. They're paying their taxes through capital gains. And capital gains is being taxed at about 15%, whereas income tax is much, much higher. I think that if we increased income taxes or we put an asset tax to fund the Defense Department, that you would see the Defense Department budget drop back down. When Bill Clinton was left office, when he handed the office over to George W. Bush, the Defense Department budget was about $325 billion. Now the Defense Department budget is close to $1 trillion, so it's almost tripled. And if we put this asset tax or we redefine how we fund the Defense Department, you're going to see the Defense Department drop dramatically.
Peter.
So I half agree with that. I agree with the part that says that the wealthy people in this country get a disproportionate share of the benefit of things like national defense for exactly the reason the caller says. And I think that is implicitly one of the reasons why even a lot of rich people like Warren Buffett will talk about how the rich should bear a bigger share of the cost of running the government. The idea of directly tying defense spending to particular families strikes me as kind of undemocratic, because as soon as that happened, they would start to say, well, if I'm going to pay for this, then I want to decide what's it done with the money, and you would end up having something more like a mercenary army that would be directly run by the wealthiest families in the country instead of an institution that's under the democratic control of the Congress.
I want to ask you maybe a political question. You end one of your recent articles talking about the federal budget being on an unsustainable path and the two political parties still miles apart on how to set it right.
Yep.
So what's a country to do?
Yeah, what's a country to do? Well, I think what we don't want to do is lose our ability to talk to each other about this. There's a sense of real alienation in the nation as a whole. People segregate themselves. They only talk to people who agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
You see that in the media with the certain networks appeal to conservatives and others to liberals. You see it in the House of Representatives. And you see it less in the Senate. The Senate was always the more collegial of the two bodies, and it retains some of that. And I think that's why I put some hope in the efforts by these six senators, the Gang of Six, to look for harmony. These are people who have strong opinions. They disagree with each other, all of them ranging from Dick Durbin, the liberal Republican, to a conservative like... let's see, who's on the Mike Crapo from Idaho. And yet they're coming together and they're saying, look, we might get a few arrows in our backs from the people in our own party, but this is too important of an issue to grandstand about. We've got to try to build a consensus around something that will actually deal with this problem, because if it gets any worse, we could be headed for a crack-up.
Yeah. Thanks, John, very much for your call. Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, I thought of another question along the way here, but I really ended up with two. First is, I wanted to know, with the debt downgrade by the S&P, since grading is really done in comparison to other forms of investment, what factors are they analyzing when the U.S. Treasury is the bellwether against all the other various opportunities to invest out there?
Yeah.
And then the other question is I know that you've talked quite a bit in this hour about what choices we make and how we make those choices. And recently, I don't know, maybe 3-4 months ago, the Times, New York Times, put out an article where they. And they did it online as well, where an individual could sit there and play games with raising revenue by increasing taxes in certain ways and by cutting spending in certain ways. And I never saw a report, because I don't think they actually collected people's individual choices on that. But I thought it was a great learning experience for everyone, and I kind of wanted to know what you thought of that and if there was maybe a way in which, Congress could take some direction in – almost in the form of a referendum about the choices that people wanted to make. If in other words, is there a political way to get at the collective wisdom of all of us?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question. I'm going to quickly go through the first part, which is the S&P. S&P actually has not yet downgraded the U.S. sovereign debt. It's simply put it on watch for possible downgrade. And we hope that if the U.S. does get its act together, that it might retain its AAA rating, which, by the way, is not a relative rating, it's more of an absolute rating, the likelihood of repayment. Now, as to collecting the collective wisdom of the nation, it's a really fascinating idea, but I loved that calculator that the New York Times put together, which is still available, I believe, online. You can look it up.
Oh, that'd be fun. I missed that.
I can't tell you the URL, but you can probably find it.
Okay.
Because it does exactly what the caller said. It gives you a chance to try it yourself. What would you do to try to balance the budget? People often give very uninformed choices when they're asked questions about what to do about the debt. You'll see them say, don't cut spending and don't raise taxes, just balance the budget.
Right.
Sorry,
right.
Folks, it doesn't happen that way.
Can't do it that way.
And so something like this tool forces you to look and say, well, you know, actually, maybe I better change my mind about, you know, not doing A or not doing B because I can't get from here to there unless I do that. And it creates a more responsible kind of discussion. I don't know if we're going to ever get into the sort of participatory democracy where it'll be a national referendum, just people pressing buttons in their homes to vote on the budget. But it would at least create a more informed electorate, and it would maybe, with a more informed electorate, you might have politicians be willing to talk straighter to people instead of pandering to their worst prejudices.
We'll try and find that. Yeah, Mike, if you know exactly where it is, we'll try and post it on our Facebook page if we can find it. I won't make promises here because I don't know if we can or not. But somebody will know. If you can call Chrissy and let her know where it is exactly, then we'll post it so we can all look at the federal budget ourselves. That'd be interesting. Thank you, Mike, very much for your call. We are running short on time here, but let's go to Bob in Waukesha. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good morning. I have first a comment and then a question. The comment is regarding the point you made earlier about the 80-year-old who is getting a great deal out of Social Security benefits right now. As a 55-year-old, I happen to run the numbers on myself, and I figure at the current levels of benefits, I'd maybe get 25% of what I would have otherwise gotten had I invested it in a normal, say, 401k or something like that. So I think for myself going into retirement down the road, I'm already taking a very big haircut on benefits, possibly more if they cut benefits more. And secondly, so that's my comment. And the second question is regarding the deficit cuts. There's so many lobbyists and so many special interests that are tugging at different angles, and nothing seems to be getting done. I know in the private sector, when companies run on hard times and they end up, having to make a cut, oftentimes what companies will do, not always ideal, but will make an across-the-board cut so everybody shares the pain equally. So if they've got to make a 20% cut in personnel, it's across the board without regard to, individual departments or whatever, maybe a little bit more equitable. And I'm just wondering if that isn't a possible way to break the stalemate of not making any sort of decision and letting the deficits just run further and further up.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Bob. Peter, we have about a minute left.
Yeah. I actually think that if it came to that, it might have to happen, but it's really not the best solution. It's like just throwing your hands up and saying, we give up, when actually we should be making decisions. There are certain budgets that can probably withstand a 20% cut and or bigger, and others that are already running on the ragged edge and can't take much of a cut at all, and we should be making intelligent decisions about which programs are in which category, and across-the-board cuts would be really just a last resort when all else fails.
Mm-hmm. What about his ideas concerning Social Security that he could have invested much better?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I can't. I haven't seen his calculations. It strikes me as rather low that I would think that your average 55-year-old and your average 401k return and projection of expected future growth and benefits. Average 55-year-old will be doing much better than that from Social Security versus a private account.
Mm-hmm. So you expect this debt ceiling to be reached by May 16th? Is that?
That's what the Treasury Department is saying.
So something needs to be done fairly soon.
I would say so.
I guess so. Thank you very much for all your information, Peter. I appreciated it and enjoyed the hour. Thanks.
Well, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Peter Coy is the economics editor for Business Week, Bloomberg's Business Week, and explaining the debt ceiling. He's written, of course, extensively about it because we've been talking about it for some time now. He began his career at the Associated Press back in 1980. We did have a listener put this New York Times link up on our Facebook page, which is great. So now you can go and play with the budget yourself. I think that'd be an interesting thing to do. Where would we put our priorities? Where would we cut? What would we do? And then, well, you could have a whole dinner party around it, right? Everybody could. And then you could all get together and see what your priorities were. It's on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to our listener for being on top of the situation. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. And thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up. Open line next hour. Get your calls and suggestions ready.